Hello, and welcome to Diabetes Dialogue, technology, therapeutics, and real-world perspectives. Diabetes Dialogue is a monthly podcast hosted by myself, Diana Isaacs, and Natalie Bellini, providing a regular news roundup of the latest clinically applicable insights across diabetes and metabolic diseases, with a focus on leveraging technology to improve care. Produced by HCP Live Endocrinology, the audio version of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, with a video version available only on hcplive.com.
Welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I'm with Natalie Bellini, and we are actually live at the ADCES Technology Conference, and we have a very special guest with us today, Dr. Stephen Russell, who is now the Chief Medical Officer at Beta Bionics. So welcome, and if you wouldn't mind just telling us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, thanks. I am an adult endocrinologist, and I trained my residency and fellowship at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And I stayed at Mass General for all my career up until this point, until about 3 weeks ago when I accepted the job at Beta Bionics. I've been working with the founder of Beta Bionics at Damiano for quite a while. First met him in 2006, and we started doing clinical studies with a very early progenitor of the Beta Bionics islet in 2008. We did inpatient studies, and then we actually did the first outpatient study of an AID or automated insulin delivery system. And over time, we refined the concept of the islet through clinical studies and learning from clinical studies. And then just recently, we completed a large pivotal study of the islet at 16 clinical sites throughout the U.S., published those results in the New England Journal of Medicine and in five other papers in the Journal of Diabetes Technology and Therapeutics. And I finally decided that the time was right to, instead of supporting the effort from within academia to take the job as chief medical officer at Beta Bionics, I'm really, really excited to be there. And some of my terrific team from Massachusetts General Hospital, Courtney Bolero and Mallory Hillard, are also coming with me to be clinical directors at Beta Bionics. So we're very excited to be joining the company and preparing, working with them to get the device approved by the FDA, and then we'll be working on the launch.
Wow.
That's phenomenal. So can you talk to us a little bit about the development of the pump itself and the history, and what was the thought process behind we need another insulin pump?
Sure. So, as you, many people are aware, one of the founders of Beta Bionics, Ed Damiano, is a applied mathematician and engineer who was working on unrelated problems to diabetes and fluid mechanics when his son was diagnosed. And that got him interested in using his expertise in applied mathematics to work on diabetes. And with a graduate student of his, Firas El-Khatib, they started developing some algorithms to automatically regulate insulin delivery. And after some initial, theoretical work, they started working with doing studies in pigs. And it was at that point that I heard about their work. I gave a talk at the Joslin Diabetes Center. And at that time, his was the first work that I'd heard of that contemplated using both insulin and glucagon to regulate blood glucose. And I was impressed with that approach. And after the talk, I approached him and suggested that I'd be interested in working with them to move towards clinical trials. And the thing that impressed me about it was that I thought that there were real limitations to what you could do with just insulin. And I think that's still the case. I mean, There are a number of AID systems out there, and they're really helpful for controlling blood glucose, but they have inherent limitations. And that is that all you can do is stop giving the insulin. and the insulin is absorbed relatively slowly. Even rapid acting insulins are absorbed slowly, and they're cleared relatively slowly. And it's kind of like being in a car and trying to avoid hitting a wall by just taking your foot off the accelerator and not having a brake. And what's great about glucagon is that if you can use glucagon, you're able to mimic the same mechanism that the intact pancreas uses to regulate blood glucose, which is to both have insulin to lower blood glucose and glucagon to stop a fall in blood glucose or to raise blood glucose. And we know that that mechanism is no longer functional in people with type 1 diabetes. Of course, the beta cells are destroyed in the autoimmune attack in type 1 diabetes, and the alpha cells are still there, but they no longer respond appropriately to hypoglycemia. And so people with diabetes no longer have this main bulwark against hypoglycemia, and glucagon can do that. And glucagon also has this additional advantage that it's absorbed much, much more quickly than insulin. So if you see hypoglycemia coming in an AID system, you can stop delivery, but that's in many cases not going to be sufficient to prevent hypoglycemia. But if you give a little bit of glucagon, that glucagon is absorbed much faster. It starts working. Typically, you can see an effect on blood glucose in 5 to 10 minutes. In fact, it's faster than taking carbs usually. And so you can use very small doses of glucagon to prevent that hypoglycemia from occurring, give the insulin levels a little time to go down, and you can save yourself from a hypoglycemia that would otherwise have required taking carbs. And so to me, it seemed like a great concept. And, the exact mechanisms of how the algorithms work and so forth have changed over the years and have been refined, but that fundamental concept has stayed the same for the bihormonal version of the bionic pancreas. And it really allows you to be much more aggressive with dosing of insulin because you have the ability to prevent a low, and allows in our pre-pivotal studies, we've shown that we can lower the mean glucose much more than you can with an insulin-only system, increase time and range much more, and at the same time, not only not increase hypoglycemia, but even decrease hypoglycemia relative to insulin-only systems.
So I'm like totally sold on this. How come the insulin-only, I guess, islet was studied first versus kind of going straight to this dual hormone?
Well, as a matter of fact, we did start with bihormonal studies. All of our first studies with the bionic pancreas were bihormonal studies using both insulin and glucagon. And we were able to do them because we were able to use the Lilly rescue glucagon, which Lilly was kind enough to supply to us, but it had to be reconstituted freshly every day. And we knew that that wouldn't be a long-term prospect. We were counting on some company developing a stable glucagon. And as a matter of fact, there are now two stable glucagons. There's the Xeris Gvoke glucagon, and then there's the Zealand Dasiglucagon or Zegalog. Now those are both approved for severe hypoglycemia rescue, and they're fantastic for that, because what a number of these companies showed in studies was that people aren't very good about reconstituting glucagon in a stressful situation. And so although if you succeed in reconstituting and injecting the medicine, it's very effective at treating a severe hypoglycemia, asking a non-medical bystander to reconstitute a drug properly, draw it up, and then inject it was a lot to ask. So what both the Xeris and the Zealand products allow you to do is to just use an EpiPen-like auto-injector. So that's fantastic. That's a real step forward for people with diabetes. But it also means that we now have glucagons that are much more stable and can be used over, a multi-day period in a bihormonal pump. And so we have been working with Zealand, who has this glucagon analog, and we've done some preliminary studies showing that the dasiglucagon works similarly to glucagon in the bihormonal bionic pancreas. And we're moving forward to prepare for a bihormonal study in the near future. But a number of years ago, we kind of reached a point where we thought, you know, we see a future for a stable glucagon, but it's not quite ready yet. And it's also the fact that we're going to have to do a much longer trial with the dasiglucagon, because that trial will be important for not only demonstrating the safety and effectiveness of the bihormonal bionic pancreas, which Beta Bionics is going to call the iLet Duo, but also to get approval for the new drug in that context. So that has to be a longer and larger trial. And we saw an opportunity to get the insulin-only system across the finish line earlier, make it available to people with diabetes. It is very much differentiated from other insulin-only AID systems. We think it really has a complementary role to other AID systems that are out there. And so, and we could do that trial more quickly, and we could get it out there. And so we thought, let's do that. Let's get the insulin-only system out there, and then we'll move on and move forward with the bihormonal system.
So can you talk a little bit about the insulin-only system? In terms of, and obviously it's not FDA approved yet. So we do have to walk that fine line, but there was a study that was published. So can you talk a little bit? And actually Diana and I were both at ATTD as part of the readout was done. So can you talk a little bit about that study?
Sure. I can talk about the results of that study. So, you know, we had done a number of preclinical studies before that, but ultimately we needed to do a large study, the design of which was agreed with the FDA to be able to present the data to them for consideration for approval. And that study was done at 16 sites across the U.S. It was a multicenter study. We decided to do that study a little differently than some of the other pivotal studies were done. We wanted to ask the question, you know, what could be the impact of this particular system if we introduced it in the environment as it is now, where there are hybrid closed loop systems already available? But we also wanted to show, so we wanted to include in our study cohort people on hybrid closed loop systems. We also wanted to show that it could be used effectively by people who were not pump users, who are multiple daily injection users. And so we wanted a mix of those sorts of people in the trial. And I should take a step back and say, you know, what is different about this system from other insulin-only automated insulin delivery systems? And it really is different in that it's initialized only with the body weight. So you enter the body weight and the system does some initial dose scaling, and then it adapts continuously and autonomously to that person's insulin needs. So you enter the body weight, it goes into closed loop mode, automated mode immediately with no learning period. And then it adapts to that individual over time. It also doesn't require any carbohydrate counting. So the system, you announce meals as a type, like breakfast, lunch, or dinner. And then for that type and for you and only for you, what is a usual meal for you, more or less? And then the system learns what you mean by that. And then we'll give 75% of the insulin predicts that you need for a meal of that type and that size. And most of the time, you should be announcing usual for me. And then the system does all correction boluses automatically. There's no such thing as a manual correction bolus. And every single dose that is given by the iLet, the size is determined by the iLet. So they can't be, there's no adjustments to make. There's no basal rate profiles. There's no carb ratios. There's no sensitivity factor. So it really is a very different sort of system.
I mean, that's incredible because we think about it. I have a lot of visits, like 30 minutes, and we spend the whole time going through the report and figuring out what to adjust. And with this, it's just all done. I mean, it might be discussing some behaviors, but it's all done by the pump.
There is one adjustment one can make, which is the glucose target. And we really like the idea of diabetes without numbers. And so the glucose targets are just usual, lower, and higher. There's three. We suggest everybody start with usual. In a few rare cases, you may start with higher. If you know you have a very high blood glucose and coming down into a tighter range might lead you to feel hypoglycemic, even if you're not And then over time, you may choose in some individuals to go to the lower target if you can do so without causing any significant hypoglycemia. But that's the only adjustment there is to make. And as you say, there are some, you know, behavioral things in terms of how to, this is very different from the kind of meal announcements that people are used to doing. And people have to be trained to do that. And they do need to understand what carbohydrates are and be able to roughly estimate the amount of carbohydrate in a meal. So as opposed to the amount of fat or the protein in a meal. So that there is carb awareness that needs to be there, just not quantitative carb counting. So it's different. And we wanted to show that it would be, we wanted to show that it would be effective and safe in a patient population that was as close as possible we could get to the patient population who actually has type 1 diabetes in the United States. So it's a mix of ways of administering insulin. We also wanted to make sure that we had a cohort that looked like the people with diabetes in the United States. So we wanted to make sure that we had plenty of racial and ethnic diversity in our cohort that matched the actual composition of the cohort.
Which I think is really important because yours is one of the first, the study that actually did that. You have more diversity in your study population than any other AID study that has been published to date right now. So I think that's really important to, and you looked at a diversity in A1C. A lot of studies won't allow someone to have an A1C that's either too high or too low. And you said, bring them on, let's put these people on. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. In terms of the racial and ethnic diversity, I think that was a very intentional choice that we wanted to do that. We asked all of our sites to make sure that they enrolled a representative cohort. Not just a finely curated cohort to make the device look good. We wanted to understand how the device would work when it was actually out in the world. And that means you need to recruit people who are similar to the people that you hope will use it, which is potentially anyone with diabetes.
All the people that need insulin, right? I mean, really, truly, right? That's the difference. That is, yeah.
And potentially also people who are underserved by current therapies. In terms of the control, the diabetes control of people, the T1D exchange has shown that only about 20% of people with type 1 diabetes have an A1C of less than 7%.
Right.
So we asked our sites to enroll no more than 20% of people with an A1C less than 7%. In the end, it wound up being more like 25%, but that was a goal. And we asked them to enroll at least a third that had an A1C above 8%. Because the T1D exchange data suggests that's about the average A1C for people with type 1 diabetes in the United States.
Right.
And we didn't have any upper limit on our A1C in the cohort. And we also, and I should say that sometimes people think, well, you don't want to enroll people with really high A1Cs because that means that they're not engaged with their diabetes. They won't even engage with the clinical trial. So they won't be good participants.
Right.
But we thought, you know, who needs... a potentially different method to manage their diabetes more than people with really high A1C. So of course we want to include those people. And we didn't exclude people on the basis of whether they'd had DKA or severe hypoglycemia in some period before the trial, as is sometimes done, because those are people who also potentially need a different way of therapy. So we really tried to be thoughtful about enrolling a cohort that would truly represent the kind of people that have type 1 diabetes in the country and that might use this device. And if we're successful in doing that, then the results of the pivotal trial can be predictive of the results that actually occur in clinical practice when the device is actually FDA cleared and available.
Wow, that's phenomenal. So what was the highest A1C in the trial? You know we have to ask these kinds of questions, right?
I believe it was, my recollection, it was around 15.
Right. Wow. Okay.
Which is pretty high.
Right.
And overall, I mean, it sounds like there was incredible time and range improvements, A1C improvements.
So what we found, our primary analysis was a comparison of a cohort that included both children, age 6 and up, and adults. So our cohort was age 6 to any age. I think our oldest participant was 84. And we combined them in a cohort and asked what our primary outcome was, the baseline adjusted change in hemoglobin A1C. And what we found is that we, in that entire cohort, we had a reduction of 0.5 percentage points in hemoglobin A1C across the cohort as a whole. And as is the case with many interventions, we found that people who had higher A1Cs got larger reductions in their A1C. But and while that's true for the islet, it's really remarkable how tight the distributions were around the mean. So if we had a wide distribution of A1Cs in our enrolled population with a long tail with some people with very, very high A1Cs, they were squished into a very, very narrow distribution. At the same time, the average went down, the variation around the average was dramatically limited. And that is a function of the adaptive nature of the bionic pancreas. If the average glucose is high, it becomes more aggressive at dosing insulin. If there's hypoglycemia, it becomes less aggressive at dosing insulin. And the effect of that is that the standard deviation around the mean, that variation around the mean, is dramatically narrowed. So not only did we lower the mean A1C, but if you were above the mean, you were above the mean by a much less margin than in the standard of care group.
Wow.
So I don't know if you can answer this, but it seems like with the simplicity of just like weight-based startup and everything, that this would be a device that I could potentially see being used in primary care, and I could see eventually being used in type 2 diabetes on multiple daily injections. So are there any plans to study this, like in a type 2 diabetes population?
Yeah, indeed there are. So we did a small feasibility study in type 2 diabetes with the insulin-only version of the islet, as yet unpublished. The results of that were encouraging, and we are interested in studying that population. Obviously, that would require a different clinical trial. Mm-hmm. We're also interested in studying the concept of whether this device can be used practically in the primary care setting in a way that is difficult for some of the other AID devices. And in fact, we are currently supporting a clinical trial of which Sean and Tamara Ozer at the University of Colorado are the PIs, looking at primary care practice compared to patients enrolled at a endocrine practice, a diabetes practice. Mm-hmm. I was the PI of that study until recently at MGH when I left MGH and went to Beta Bionics, and now Melissa Putman, my colleague at Mass General Hospital, is the PI of the MGH side of that study. And the hypothesis is that it won't matter who is supporting the patient, that they will both be able, that both cohorts, the people recruited by the diabetes practice and the people recruited by the primary care practice, are able to achieve effective and safe glucose control with the islet. Now, I do have to say that Sean and Tamara Ozer are not typical primary care doctors.
Right.
They have a connection to type 1 diabetes that's both personal and professional, but it allows us to at least start to explore that, and we are actively interested in supporting other trials that could explore that in more detail. You know, of course, a primary care physician could prescribe any insulin pump or an AID system, but I think that it's often more than they have time for to make adjustments to, you know, basal rate profiles and carb to insulin ratios and sensitivity factors in a busy primary care practice. And so what we need to test in one of these studies is it feasible to use the islet in that setting? And if it is, and, you know, and we can publish peer-reviewed research that suggests that the case, then I think, you know, primary care doctors will be more willing to explore the idea of using this sort of device with their patients with type 1 diabetes.
Right. And the hard part is, as we all know, there's not enough endocrinology practicing clinicians out there to see all, never mind just the type 1, but now we have to look at the type 2 population. Even just the insulin requiring patients in the United States, there's not enough. you and I and Diana would work 24/7, 365, we still couldn't get to just the ones in our own communities, right? And that's the truth across the United States. So we need to get more care into that primary care practice. And it is that there are fewer and fewer endocrinologists in these rural areas, and those patients deserve the same care that you can provide in Boston and we can provide in Cleveland and those kinds of things, right? So that's a big part of it. Yeah.
That reminds me of a joke someone told me when I was going to go to you know, Boston to do my residency and fellowship. I already knew I wanted to be an endocrinologist, and someone said, "Oh, another endocrinologist in Boston? That's like sending coal to Newcastle."
Right.
Transporting water to the ocean.
Right.
So in certain places, you know, there's a lot of endocrinologists and a lot of other care providers for people with diabetes, diabetes educators, so forth. So, you know, our patients can have a great support system, but clearly that is not evenly distributed around the country. And John and Tamara Oser have shown that there are huge swaths of the country where there are no endocrinologists of any description. And by and large, that means that also they don't have the diabetes educators and they don't have the registered dietitians and all the support staff that really makes a diabetes clinic, right? And so those things aren't there. So a lot of those people are being managed by primary care doctors. And because primary care doctors don't have the time to do pump and CGM management by and large, a lot of those folks are not being able to take advantage of these new technologies. And so, and really, when you think about it, we think maybe a third of people, you know, with type 1 diabetes in the United States, as a rough guess, are using a hybrid closed loop system. Right. Hybrid closed loop systems, the ones that already exist, are amazing.
Right.
They've really been a game changer, but they're still challenging for some people to use because they still require all the skills of being a pumper. You still have to count carbs. You still have to do manual corrections to get the best care, get the best average. And so they can still be a challenge for some people. You know, there are people who have really good quantitative skills and, you know, are really organized, and those people tend to do great with their diabetes. But that's not the majority of people.
Right.
And then even people who have all of those sort of predispositions that would make them potentially very good at managing their diabetes, if they're not in a place where they can get the support they need to use the current tools available, they're not going to have access to them. And so, you know, my goal in working on this project was to try and make a method of diabetes management that was more inclusive. And the idea was, I've said this many times, is to democratize good diabetes care, you know, good glucose control. It should, you know, we're not about trying to take people who are already under really good control and make them a little bit better, right? We're looking to take people who are really challenged with their control and give them better glucose control, reduce their risk of complications, and ideally also reduce the amount of time that they spend thinking about their diabetes, the cognitive overhead of constantly thinking about managing their blood sugar, which people without diabetes don't have to do.
Right. That disease burden is so, so big for those patients.
Yeah.
Right?
So it sounds like you guys are trying to target like the 2/3 that are not on pump therapy that could be great candidates.
I think that's true. I mean, I certainly think there are people who are already on pump therapy that benefit. I mean, we saw that in the pivotal trial. Everybody benefited to different degrees. The people who were on MDI had the highest A1Cs at baseline, and they saw the largest reductions in A1C with the bionic pancreas. But people who are on pumps and people who are on hybrid closed loop systems also saw significant reductions in A1C. And in all those cases, we were able to do that without seeing an increase in time less than 54 milligrams per deciliter hypoglycemia. So
that's without the glucagon.
Right.
And that's without the glucagon. And that's what we're focused on right now.
Yeah.
We're, you know, that the results from that trial were submitted to the FDA. And the FDA had granted Beta Bionics that breakthrough device designation on the iLet. And they have been great partners in dialogue with the company about what, you know, information they needed to see from the clinical trial and in providing questions about that data. And so we're currently in that dialogue process back and forth with the FDA. And we're hoping that we will, be able to announce an approval sometime soon. I can't say the exact timing of that.
Right. Yep.
The FDA has obviously been challenged by COVID and the amount of work they needed to do for that. And so approval times for a lot of things have stretched out, but, they've been great partners in this. So we are hoping to be able to say that soon and get it out to, first, probably the people who the sites that were involved in the clinical trials, and then expand, hopefully expand from there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Really an incredible conversation, and I look forward to what's in store for the future. And thanks to our viewers for attending this episode of Diabetes Dialogue.
Thanks very much. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.